You may begin when ready, sir. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Well, I'd ask to reserve 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, my name is James Ilovich. I'm representing Mr. Donald Arthur Harrington on his appeal from the Circuit Court of Stafford County. We have several issues to address. I'll deal with the outliers first, and then several I think are part of a group. First of all, one of the first things that happened procedurally in this case was following a preliminary hearing and indictment on one charge, counsel at that time filed a motion to quash that charge, because the Commonwealth Attorney essentially amended the certified warrant before it got to the grand jury, so the grand jury only heard essentially evidence on possession of intent to distribute. The trial court had originally had a warrant for possession of intent to distribute, certified only on possession, and then of course the Commonwealth did what it did. This is obviously a question of procedure. In its reply brief, the Commonwealth states many reasons and many ways that opportunities the Commonwealth has to address indictment issues, but none of those occurred in this particular case.
As I understand it, and this is maybe I'm misreading the facts, is that the case went to preliminary hearing before what I call a major drug offense. And after listening to the evidence, the trial judge at the preliminary hearing made a determination to reduce the charge to a lesser serious drug offense. Case goes up to the grand jury, and after the case goes up to the grand jury, the indictment appears for the greater drug offense that the trial judge had dismissed, not dismissed, but had reduced at the preliminary hearing level, and the case did not go through what I call the traditional direct indictment framework to come up with the greater charge. Is that true?
That's correct, Your Honor. And okay. Appendix 21 is the one indictment. Obviously, this would even be an issue if the Commonwealth State sought a direct indictment. So there were two indictments in this case, one charging possession with intent to distribute, but they did not do that. Counsel raised the issue in a timely manner. They actually continued the arraignment so he could raise it and pointed out to the judge that there's just no procedure for this. And
Counsel, may I interrupt you?
Sure.
How is your case different from the case Ashby v. Commonwealth? Are you familiar with that case?
No, ma'am, no.
It's 33 Virginia App 540, and a very similar case to your case in that the defendant had been charged with one thing and being held, of course, gone through grand jury, being held on that particular charge, and then the Commonwealth Attorney supplanted basically that particular charge with the original and added some to indictment and didn't null pros the prior charge. And this court thought that was appropriate.
Well, I guess the issue is, and that goes back to a statute actually, if you're arrested on a warrant for a criminal offense, then you're entitled to a preliminary hearing on that offense. If, however, prior to service of that warrant, you're indicted by a grand jury, say, then you're not. So I think procedures are laid out specifically in that case, though I'm not familiar with it, obviously
it's exactly the same as I read it. You might want to look at it.
Well,
it seems very similar.
Well, and I guess that the Commonwealth actually did some work and went out and obtained additional documents. The Commonwealth did not see that it was appropriate to supplant what a general district court judge had done. And I would say that I think this is much more in line with having to look at what the Commonwealth did exactly. And she amended the indictment. I mean, there's no two ways. She amended the warrant when presenting the indictment to the grand jury. Again, she didn't have to do that. She could have null prosed it. She could have not presented it, presented a direct indictment. She could have done a lot of things, but she amended it. And what does that mean exactly? Well, if we had already gotten through grand jury, and let's say he was indicted for possession, and then the Commonwealth sought to amend it to possession with intent to distribute, that the trial court would have to make a determination about has she substantially changed the nature of the offense charged. We may not just do it automatically. The court may ultimately do it, but there has to be some consideration. And that would be between a probable cause body, if you will, the grand jury, and then the trial, whatever the trier of fact. Here, there was a probable cause body, if you will, the preliminary hearing court judge, the general district court judge, and then the grand jury, and I'm not sure why the Commonwealth wouldn't be held to the same standard is to show why this isn't necessary. And again, the Commonwealth could have done so many things in this case and had so many remedies. They could have, again, null pros, direct indicted, if moved to amend, and let's say the trial court denied that, okay, null pros, direct indict. They could have direct indicted before went to preliminary hearing. I mean, just so many things.
I agree with you. I went exactly down the same road we're going down. And then found this case, and but I don't disagree with you. You know, I think that both the Commonwealth and defense have the same responsibilities. We all understand they've been outlined by the General Assembly and as well as case law. But I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that there are things that have to change my mind when I read them, and they're still good law. So if you want to move on to some of your other issues.
Yes, ma'am. The next, I think, is kind of deal with as a trifecta, because they all kind of roll into each other. When Mr. Harrington got to trial on the 8th of January, his trial, his now second trial counsel, had to move to withdraw. And the reason he had to move to withdraw was because of a conflict of interest, not with Mr. Harrington, but because of prior representation. At the time the counsel withdrew from the case, Mr. Harrington stated that he wished to go forward. As a matter of fact, he stated, by my count, at least three separate times. And even though later on the trial judge said, well, I don't know that there was an equivocal representation by him that he wanted to represent himself, I have him saying, I want to represent myself, I want to go forward today, and I believe one more time, I want to represent myself at trial. So it seems like he was very clear and very unequivocal about wanting to represent himself on that day. The judge declined to do that. But I would say that prior to making or to declining, he didn't do what he would be required to do under Feretta v. California in cases after that. He didn't consider whether it was a timely request. I would argue that in this particular case, it certainly was. It was prior to trial. He didn't begin any kind of colloquy with this defendant about whether he would be able to do that, to represent himself at trial. Now, he got a little help from the Commonwealth on it's that a, because...
Isn't it true, though, that the trial judge appointed... standby counsel to sort of help the defendant work his way through this request that he was making, which, you know, to me does not sound like an unreasonable thing. I know that when I sat as a trial judge, whenever I had a person say, I want to represent myself, I always got a little uneasy because, number one, I knew that we would have Feretta problems, and number two, I was like, I want to make sure that this gentleman or lady understands the significance of what they're doing. And quite frankly, I'll give you some inside golf here. I would cherry pick one of the more competent attorneys in my jurisdiction to help this person understand the significance of what they were doing. And oftentimes this person would come back to court and say, I've spoken with Ms. Jones and she's told me how stupid I am by representing myself, and then makes a decision that I want to go forward with a lawyer now.
Right.
So what was so bad about this judge taking the same approach that learned trial judge Alston took when he was on the
trial
bench?
Well, I think that with Mr. Harrington, at least. Well, because this had cascading issues that came behind it, obviously. On the 8th of January, if the case had gone forward, some things that would have come into evidence later on would not have come into evidence. Also, the case may or may not, ultimately, we'll talk about, I'm not using too much time, about speedy trial, may not have come into play. The bottom line is one of the cases that the court has to consider, or is asked to consider, is the Edwards case, you know, where that particular defendant made a mess of his case. He had fired several counsel. He just would not work with anybody. But even at the end of that, the court said that his request to represent himself should have been considered by the trial judge because it was timely made. And I don't disagree with what the trial judge did on that particular date. However, I think when you have to consider what the defendant has a right not to be represented, as the courts have said, as well as to be represented, I think there should have been, I think it's arguable that the judge should have been something for the record at least to consider why he felt that was necessary.
So your position is essentially that the trial court undermined the defendant's ability to represent himself by appointing standby counsel and thereby building a delay in the case when it was clear from the record that the defendant wanted to represent himself on that day.
Well, I would certainly say that, and the defendant at the conclusion of the hearing asked, you know, to whom is this delay attributable, and the trial court said it's attributable to you, which I would also, I guess, to segue into speedy trial considerations, we would say that is wrong. This defendant was prepared to go forward, stated unequivocally he was prepared to go forward on the 8th of January. The factors that a court has to consider when considering speedy trial is, what did he do to necessarily hamstring his ability to go forward that day? If he was like an Edwards defendant, say, and there was a conflict of interest, was not working with his attorney or something like that, then perhaps it would be attributable to him.
Did he waive that, however, on down the road when he came up for his trial on March the 11th? And his attorney stated, you know, no, he wants, you know, me to, he wants to be represented by counsel and he doesn't want to represent himself.
Well, I guess ultimately, Your Honor, we have to consider how far ahead do you get to work? I mean, I think we have to look at what the trial judge did on a particular day in terms of, in the context of that day.
With your speedy trial, I realize that that's how you...
Well, I guess to get to that, I see the yellow light. I mean, ultimately, I mean, by my calculation at least, if you added that time, remove the arraignment continuance of 11 days, and then go from the Commonwealth's continuance until actual trial date, you still get it 156 days. And one of the reasons, obviously, goes into this motion to continue. The Commonwealth, that both new counsel, Mr. Brown, and the Commonwealth agreed on a specific trial date. They agreed on that date on the January 28th, set the case for February 20th. On February 20th, not before, the Commonwealth made a motion to continue. And we would argue, and I think it's, you know, stated well enough, and I think the court will have to make a determination, was there due diligence by the Commonwealth saying that it was looking for evidence that it had its possession for, at that point, 7 or 8 months, but had only just got a search warrant?
Let's go back just a little bit, and I know we're bouncing you around, but you're doing a very good job. The date that the defendant evidenced his desire to represent himself, was that a traditional trial date, or was that some sort of motions date or hearing date?
That was his trial date, right?
Okay, so that was his trial date, because there seemed to be some confusion as to whether or not this was a motions day for him to remove counsel or whatever.
Well, counsel had also filed a Mr. Cornick, I think, to protect his client, had said, you know, filed a motion to continue. That was not addressed by the court, though, in one way or another, nor did he ever turn to Mr. Harrington and ask him whether he desired to continue the case. They simply continued the case.
Okay, so essentially what you had is you had a trial date and counsel knew that his client no longer wanted him representing him, and so counsel very diligently said, I need to get out because my client doesn't want me anymore. I need your court to take up this issue before we get to the main issue of whether or not the defendant is going to be able to represent himself on this date.
Right.
Okay.
And then of course, as I think of motion to continue, again, I think that on that date, his trial counsel at that time objected. And while that has speedy trial implications, of course, is if speedy trial, as I think Judge Sharp had said, speedy trial told from January 28th until February 20th, which was the new setting of the date when he was available, and the case law is pretty clear that counsel has to be available, and if he's not, then essentially, you know, it's on the defendant. But once he said he was available and that date came and went because the Commonwealth asked to continue, then the clock starts again. And again, by our count, the Commonwealth exceeded the statutory minimum. And that number, I guess to go back to the very first argument, I mean, statutes are in place for a reason. If you talk about whether the Commonwealth could bring a direct indictment or could not put the word direct on top of this particular indictment, you know, there's no procedure for that. The statute has some meaning. It's always to protect the defendant. I had to go back and kind of remind myself through the case law, what's the grand jury there for? It's another layer of protecting the defendant, essentially, after a preliminary hearing court judge. I know it's become, at least on my side of that, we think of it as something else, but the purpose there is to protect the defendant. And so it's the same for the speedy trial statute, and there's some serious starting and stopping here, but ultimately, because the Commonwealth moved to continue, and we would argue, certainly not with good grounds, it prejudiced the defendant and had his case set past speedy trial.
Okay, you're in your rebuttal time. We'll save the rest for rebuttal, counsel.
Yes, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court, unless the court is interested in hearing about any of the other issues briefed, I'll limit myself to the same.
Let me get to the one that's causing me consternation and also apparently Judge Chafin. There, as you know, there is a process for how a particular defendant is processed through the court system. Person's arrested, and if they're charged with a felony, they go to a preliminary hearing. They go to a preliminary hearing, the judge finds whether or not there's probable cause, and most times indicts, occasionally, as did happen in this case, the judge will indict on a lesser charge. And the Commonwealth, at that point, has a couple of options. They can go to the grand jury and seek indictment on the lesser charge, or they can null pros the matter, bring it back, and bring a direct indictment, or, as they're sitting in the grand jury, they can ask for a direct indictment on the charge that they originally sought in the trial court. It just seemed a little strange to me that the Commonwealth's attorney could basically overrule the trial judge's determination of probable cause and say, oh, no, we weren't happy with that determination. We're not going to follow the procedure. We're going to indict him ourselves without the benefit of any process that is anywhere in the statute. And even though there's a case that seems to suggest they can do that, why should the government be able to do that?
Several points in response, Your Honor. First, the Ashby case, I was reviewing my brief, and I see about 10 cases, the Commonwealth side of which unfortunately doesn't include that one. I think I've read it at some point in my life. I don't remember its details very well now, but from what Judge Chaffin said, it certainly seems pretty similar to what we have here, so that would be the first point, that it didn't do anything in contravention of that. We also have the fact this defendant was not denied a preliminary hearing. There's no assertion about that. There's no dispute about the fact that as long as the district court does not do either two things, either one, adjudicate a lesser included offense, which it has the right to do but is not obligated to do, or two, in the specific example of a misdemeanor where it must adjudicate it on the merits, otherwise its action does not in any way bind a prosecution on the original felony charge. And a good example of that is the Supreme Court case Moore v. Commonwealth, which is discussed in some detail in the Commonwealth's brief. Because there, and getting back to Your Honor's question about sort of trying to ignore what the General District Court did, I mean, there, the District Court, quote unquote, dismissed the original felony charges, which is a greater action than anything that happened here. The Commonwealth thereafter obtained grand jury indictments charging the original offenses. And by the way, there's no indication in the Moore opinion that that was a quote unquote direct indictment. I mean, the language is obtained from the grand jury indictments against the defendant charging the same offenses. And the Supreme Court, and then so the person was prosecuted and convicted on those original offenses. And the Supreme Court said that, in so many words, that was fine. He'd gotten his preliminary hearing. The district court had not done various things that it could have done, such as to adjudicate, to convict on the lesser included offense. It merely found no probable cause. The Supreme Court said that meant that jeopardy had not attached, and the Commonwealth was perfectly free
Doesn't that effectively render the statutory provisions, essentially, as I look at it, controlling the Commonwealth's prerogative in the case a nullity if they can just say, okay, we just want to do it this way, even though there's no statutory framework for them to do that?
Well, I don't know of any statute that prescribes as such what happened here, and without in any way trying to sound glib, mm-hmm. The Supreme Court held what it held. Seems to me quite clear that it held what it held. Again, there was a greater loss, so to speak, for the Commonwealth in that General District Court preliminary hearing. The charges were dismissed. It wasn't that, well, I found evidence of crime. It's just not at the level that was prosecuted.
I have to go back and look at Moore, because I thought Moore stood for the proposition that the outcome of a preliminary hearing does not control the Commonwealth's decision to proceed with direct indictment of a felony charge against the defendant, which I absolutely agree with. They can proceed to a direct indictment, but here, in our case, it doesn't appear that it was proceeding on a direct indictment, that they just did something else.
Well, as I understand a direct indictment, it seems to me this was a direct indictment in everything but formal name, because you had here the Commonwealth presenting evidence to the grand jury, and the grand jury returned indictment on the possession with intent to discharge the original, mm-hmm. more serious crime. To me, I don't really see any significant material difference between that and a quote-unquote direct indictment. I will note that the Commonwealth said near the end of the argument, Court, if it matters, we'll be glad to add the word direct. The judge said, I don't think it does. I think he indicated himself, and I know it's in our brief, that you have a statute saying mere words of omission or surplusage are not enough to vitiate an indictment.
I agree with exactly what occurred, and I have the same heartburn, but of course, I think...
I have some pills.
But I don't think that'll help me on this one.
Well,
but thank you.
Soliciting votes.
but the problem here, of course, trickles on down to the issue of the time frame as to when does your time begin running. And if we look at it, according to the Ashby case, of course, it starts running again from that new indictment, you know, which would be the October date, and then, you know, you don't have any problem, ultimately, with your statutory scheme there as far as your time.
Well, so, let me go, that's, I guess, as good a time as any to segue to what I think is a lot of ways the most interesting issues, related issues in this case, which are the Feretta / statutory speedy trial claims. Mm-hmm. And Commonwealth's perfectly prepared to defend on the basis of the other date. First of all, it is quite clear, and the defense counsel, I think at least twice in response to questions put to him by the trial judge, expressly limited his statutory speedy trial argument to the 16 days that ran from the January 8th, 2013 hearing where this defendant made noises about wanting to proceed and being his own attorney, and the hearing 16 days later on the 24th when the new attorney, by that time, had a chance to talk with him. I think the argument on brief may go beyond that, but plainly under terms of default, approbate, and reprobate, disallowance of inconsistent positions, he is bound by his explicit 16-day statutory speedy trial claim. That in turn gets us to what happened on the January 8th date, because if there was no problem there, then by the express terms of his statutory speedy trial claim, he loses. And I think it's important, first of all, and this goes to Judge Alston's question about the nature of the hearing on January 8th. It's interesting, the first attorney appointed for the defendant from the public defender's office was permitted to withdraw at a hearing on December 17th for the reason that another member of the public defender's office, turned out, was representing the informant in this case, which, according to the Harrington, the defendant here was one of the primary villains in all of this, so obviously you couldn't have multiple representations of two such antithetical figures. And at page 141 of the appendix, the court says at the end of that December hearing, all right, I'm going to allow you to withdraw, Mr. Herr, that's the public defender, attorney number one. Your case is still set for January 8th unless your new counsel isn't available that day. It may have to be moved. So this would by no means be there on January 8th with bells on because we're going to go. This was far from that. That was, by its very description, a much more provisional situation. So we come to January 8th, and in fact, attorney number two now is seeking, as per the remarks of his law partner who was there on his behalf, to withdraw because he has his own conflict. And by the way, I think I heard counsel suggest that at this hearing, the defendant was unhappy with his attorney and wanted him out. That's incorrect. Both of these motions to withdraw were entirely occasioned by conflicts of interest that the defense attorney had identified and then sought to rectify by getting out of the case. So it's pretty clear that this hearing was not going to be for a trial, and that's important because under Feretta, there's no absolute right of self-representation. The court has the right to maintain the integrity and efficiency of its court calendar, and there's not the slightest indication that the Commonwealth on January 8th expected to or was prepared to actually try the case, or that anyone other than Harrington with these easily offered assertions of wanting to go forward and represent himself was for the defendant. So what I'm saying is the circuit court had the right to give primacy to the nature of that hearing. The nature of that hearing was to appoint a new attorney. The court absolutely acknowledged the right of this defendant under Feretta, if all the necessary prerequisites were satisfied, to represent himself. Never said, I'm not going to allow you to do it. He said, I'm just going to, at this procedural hearing, which in effect was the January 8th hearing, I'm going to appoint a new attorney. I want him to talk with you. And then when you come back, which turned out to be only 16 days later, if you still wish to represent yourself, then we'll undertake the necessary steps. And in so many words, there's every reason to think that the court would have allowed him to represent himself.
But doesn't the footnote to all of this suggest that, and I'm not suggesting anything devious on the part of the Commonwealth here, but the Commonwealth wasn't ready to go forward either 4 or 6 weeks later because there was some witness that they should have subpoenaed that they hadn't subpoenaed that they had to try to subpoena to get back in 2 weeks. So if they weren't going to be ready to go in 6 weeks, they weren't going to be ready to go 6 weeks earlier, which sort of lends credence to the defendant's view that, look, this is just a Commonwealth prolonging this thing and my rights are being implicated.
I think the Commonwealth's request on February 8th, I think it was, to for a two-week continuance, I think it has to be evaluated on its own merits. It was either the trial court either appropriately exercised its discretion at that time in denying, in granting the short motion, or it didn't. I don't think the defendant himself has argued that what happened thereafter somehow goes to vitiate what happened on January 8th. But the other part of it is, and I think the Edwards case says it quite clearly, you have to have a timely, clear, and unequivocal, and valid request of self-representation. In this case, to put it mildly, and the cases make clear, you have to look at the record as a whole. It's not like, for example, in a custodial interrogation situation, if the defendant says the magic words, I don't want to speak with you anymore, I want an attorney. That's it. Here, the mere fact that he just out of the blue says, I want to represent myself, I'm ready to go forward, which again ignored the true nature of that hearing, is only part of the equation. The fact is, shortly after that, when the court said, I'm not denying your request, I'm simply deferring it briefly while the purpose of this hearing is to decide whether or not to bring in another attorney, which I'm doing. And shortly after that, when they were talking about the possible attorney number three, Harrington, who just a few minutes earlier was saying, I want to represent myself, said, well, what about Ben Woodridge? Is he's available? Hardly someone who seemed intent on defending himself come hell or high water. And then near the end of the hearing, he also said, is this delay going to count against the Commonwealth or me? The judge thereafter said that his actions at that hearing were totally inconsistent with someone who wanted to go forward.
It also would seem to suggest someone who knew the process because he knew to ask the critical question, who is this counting against?
Right, and that's in turn, at the very least, could be viewed as someone trying to manipulate the system. And considering he had 10 prior convictions for it, which were for perjury, he was hardly a novice to the criminal justice system. Point, the trial, under the case law that I've discussed in detail and brief, these are essentially factual findings as to whether the request was clear and unequivocal. It plainly was not. And for that reason alone, what the court did was appropriate. If the Feretta ruling is not well taken, then by their own express description of their speedy trial claim in the circuit court, they lose on that by the necessary application of that Feretta ruling.
Okay.
Thank
you.
I ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Counsel, you have about a minute.
Just 1 minute?
Yes, sir.
And now 58 seconds. Your Honor, this case seems to boil down, and I obviously didn't get to other issues such as mistrial, insufficiency evidence, but I'll try to do those in 20 seconds. The sufficiency evidence, it seems to be a so what. He's charged with possession with intent to distribute. He's possessing a Schedule 1 or 2 substance he has a lawful prescription for. The basis of his intent to distribute comes from text messages that no one ever witnessed him doing, that there was evidence to the contrary that someone else may have made those text messages, but ultimately the finder of fact says, so what? With regard to the mistrial issues, counsel appropriately raised 3 separate times, twice asking for a mistrial, once after the conclusion of the trial, asking again for a mistrial, which I would disagree with the Attorney General. I believe that that is a timely request made. The trial judge kind of referred him and said, argue this after the jury goes. And again, the trial court said, no matter what, no matter how the jury is tainted, we're going to instruct the jury, so what? But these procedural issues, Your Honor, I think it's sort of in the same vein. Ultimately, the Commonwealth can do whatever they want, well, so what? Because they could do something else. All of the cases in the AG's brief, they're all good law, obviously, as is the Ashby case, but none of them have the Commonwealth attorney amending an indictment or amending in the way that this Commonwealth did. That's not a so what issue. I would say on January 8th, it was still set for trial. No, there was no intervening case, no intervening change, no intervening order that changed that from a trial date. So his demand or his request that I would argue the trial court did not follow up with resulted in a continuance. So what? Well, then obviously that begins a whole chain of consequences with regard to speedy trial, with regard to the Commonwealth's request to a continuance. So what? So what? Well, ultimately, I think there's such a chain of circumstances here, especially the procedural, we'd ask the court to reverse or either remand or dismiss.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. We'll come down to Greek counsel. You may